Kilauea volcano continues to challenge emergency management crews. We'll have more on that story, but first, we turn our attention to China. Every other year, Hawaii hosts the largest naval military exercise in the world. It's called RIMPAC, the Rim of the Pacific Exercises. And for the past two versions, China has taken part. China was going to be part of the summer's drills until yesterday when the United States officially disinvited the Chinese Navy. For some perspective on this, HPR News Director Bill Dorman spoke with David Chambaugh, a longtime China expert who will be giving a talk tomorrow at the East-West Center in Honolulu. Chambaugh is the director of the China Policy Program at George Washington University and has advised companies and the U.S. government on China policy. He says disinviting China may not be a shock, but it's a significant move.
Well, I think it's symbolically significant and may even be substantively significant. Symbolically, it obviously shows American government's displeasure with China's militarization of the South China Sea land features, they're called. These are sort of pseudo-islands, but they look like an island. They talk like an island. They walk like an island, but they're not called islands. Anyway, the Chinese have seven of them that they've reclaimed a lot of land on in the last 2 years. They've laid down airstrips capable of taking bombers. A Chinese bomber landed on one of these airstrips 2 days ago, and ostensibly the disinvitation for RIMPAC, the U.S. government says, is in response to that action, the bomber landing, which is a tangible form of, quote, militarization. Now, Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, when he visited the White House and met with President Obama at the end of the Obama administration, promised in the Rose Garden that China shall not, quote, militarize, unquote, the South China Sea islands. Since then, they have, as I say, put in all the facilities, deep water port that can take, large destroyers, submarine pens, long runways, 10,000-foot runways that can take both fighters and bombers, hangars for fighters, all the facilities for troops. They've got the whole infrastructure laid down in these six or seven atolls. They just haven't put in the equipment. Well, they have put in some of the equipment, actually, anti-aircraft missiles. Mm-hmm. But now they're clearly moving in that direction. Mm-hmm. They're moving towards militarization, and it won't be a matter of months, really, before we have full power projection forces, Chinese forces down there. So anyway, the Trump administration is showing its displeasure with that by disinviting China from RIMPAC. Substantively, it means that the Chinese have only participated in RIMPAC, I believe, three times since 2014. Yes, they're a major navy, a second major navy, or third major navy, I should say, in Asia after Japan and the United States. Mm-hmm. RIMPAC is, in theory, a multilateral exercise for navies, but also for allied navies. Mm-hmm. China is clearly not an ally of the United States, nor is it a strategic partner. And, in fact, it's increasingly a strategic competitor. So the U.S. Navy and I would dare say the Pentagon and the Pacific Command have always been a little uneasy about allowing the Chinese ships, from an intelligence standpoint, to participate and be that in RIMPAC and be that close to the American and other allied vessels. So there's been some ambivalence about Chinese inclusion in RIMPAC for a number of years. This South China Sea situation, in a sense, gives the U.S. government, an excuse to disinvite them for this year, at least.
When the Pentagon made that announcement, a spokesman said that it's as an initial response to China's continued militarization of the South China Sea. So if this is an initial response, where does that go?
Yeah, good question. The Trump administration has several times said that there will be consequences, I think is the term they use. Former Secretary of State Tillerson used that term in his confirmation hearings. White House spokesperson Sarah Sanders used that term, I think, about a week ago. Well, we'll see what the consequences are and what further steps the U.S. will take. I'm not privy to that. We could envision stepped up freedom of navigation operations or overflights. But, what is the United States really going to do? Or what is the United States capable of doing if the Chinese put military forces on these islands? I dare say not much.
And, that touches on a broader theme in terms of, and you've written about this, about the perception that U.S. influence in Southeast Asia is on the decline, China's influence in the region is on the rise.
Well, that's the meta narrative, you might say, in the region. And indeed, worldwide. But certainly in Southeast Asia, over the last 2 years, China's influence has been perceived to be rising. And, you know, perception matters a lot in international relations. And all these countries, to some degree or less, are gravitating increasingly towards China. At the same time, the transition from the Obama administration to the Trump administration has created a kind of vacuum in the region. Of course, the Trump administration's taken some time to get its footing, you might say, and to work out its Asia policy. I wouldn't say it's worked out yet. But this is at a time when the Chinese are increasing their own presence in not just military terms, but economically, primarily, diplomatically, even so-called soft power. Culture, you know, the One Belt, One Road program. So the Chinese are just being very proactive in a number of areas, whereas the U.S. is seen to be less engaged in Southeast Asia. I argue, in fact, in the research I'm doing and in the book I'm writing, that the U.S. has many more intrinsic strengths in Southeast Asia than does China. It's just not the narrative. It's not the perception. And Southeast Asians have good reason to question the American, you know, sort of steadfastness and presence. The U.S. is episodic at best in the region. Now, the Obama administration, I quickly have to say, I think deserves credit because it broke that episodic pattern. You know, they made a commitment to Southeast Asia that no previous administration had, and Southeast Asians got kind of accustomed to that. In comes Trump, and we're back to the episodic disengagement, you might say.
Within that world, on the diplomatic side, concern in a lot of quarters about hollowing out of diplomatic personnel and in terms of the infrastructure, really, in the State Department and other areas of the government dealing with Asia in particular, but including Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. How much of a concern for you?
Well, certainly under Tillerson's tenure as Secretary of State, there was a horrendous, not just hollowing out, hemorrhaging is the term I would use, of Foreign Service officers and State Department personnel at very senior, at all ranks. In fact, I went to give a lecture at the Foreign Service Institute outside of Washington last week where we train our Foreign Service officers, and it was like a ghost town. There is no incoming class of Foreign Service officers right now. That was Tillerson's doing. Tillerson put a hiring freeze in the State Department. He had no incoming class, no young people coming in. Senior officials were leaving in droves. The morale in the U.S. State Department, terrible. Could not be worse. Worst it's probably ever been. Now we have Secretary of State Pompeo, who has promised to, quote, restore the swagger, unquote, to the State Department. And that's welcome, put it mildly. He's also lifted the hiring freeze on dependents, American dependents and embassies abroad. And so there is, at the moment, I would say, some optimism after a year and a half of deep pessimism amongst U.S. officials. The other thing to say is that we still don't have an Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia Pacific Affairs. Mm-hmm. We have an acting one, a very able person, Susan Thornton. And our government's just not staffed out on Asia or any other part of the region. We have acting ambassadors, chargés, you know. This is really, it's all contributing to this perception of a disengaged, declining, you know, distracted United States. While China, on the other hand, is there 24/7.
And yet, you say that in terms of influence in the region, for example, soft power, which a lot of times is written about in the region, mm-hmm. as far as China goes, whether that's with a lot of the economic deals, a lot of helping Thailand's train, other projects, Belt mm-hmm. and Road. But you say that that's more of a power for the United States. How do you see that?
Yeah, I would say not just in the category of soft power, but if you even look at economic power, which will surprise you, or strategic power, the U.S. has more strengths in the region than does China. So let's start with soft power quickly. Let's take students. There are 45,000 Southeast Asian students in American – 54,000 Southeast Asian students in American universities this academic year. I don't know the number of Southeast Asian students in Chinese universities. I'd guess they would be less than 20,000. American sports, you know, people across Southeast Asia right now are watching the NBA playoffs. They're not watching the CBA playoffs. American film, American popular culture still resonates deeply across Southeast Asian countries, less in some countries, particularly Islamic countries like Indonesia mm-hmm. and Malaysia. But the U.S., you know, has a deep reservoir of interactions since the Second World War in Southeast Asia, and even perceptions, if you do look at surveys of Southeast Asian perceptions of the U.S., still quite positive. Then you move to the economic sphere. It might surprise you, Bill, given the Chinese economic presence in Southeast Asia. Well, the United States has more than three times the foreign direct investment in Southeast Asia than does China.
That's historically over time.
Over time. Mm-hmm. In fact, U.S. investment is greater than China, Japan, and the EU combined. But even on an annual basis, in the last 2 years, the U.S. FDI was $12 billion. The Chinese are at $9 billion. Now, trade levels, to be sure, the Chinese trade almost 2-to-1 more than the U.S., but the United States is $224 billion in trade, quarter of a trillion dollars in trade with ASEAN.
No small amount.
That's not
yes.
a small amount. ASEAN is America's fourth largest trading partner.
And ASEAN generally, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, is a growing component, certainly in terms of U.S. awareness, seemingly.
Absolutely, and a priority, and it ought to be a priority, although it's not always given the priority status it deserves. And then just lastly, if you look at security assistance, so we're here in Honolulu where the Pacific Command is, of course, headquartered. And if you look at all the Southeast Asian countries, yes, one or two of them are dependent on China for their military supplies and training, Myanmar, Cambodia, and to some extent Laos. But seven of the 10 are all dependent on the United States. We train their forces. We supply their forces. We equip their forces. We do a lot together and have been for decades. So, you know, China doesn't provide – there are no alliances for China in Southeast Asia. In fact, Southeast Asians are interestingly – ambivalent about China. On the one hand, they welcome the economic interactions. Some of them, like Thailand, have cultural ties. Certainly the diaspora, Chinese communities across the region are part of it. But there's also a lot of suspiciousness and distrust and wariness of China. So the Southeast Asians have – this is not new. They've been kind of trying to navigate that middle space between the U.S. and China for some time.
Thank you very much, David. David Shamba is an award-winning writer, the Gaston Seeker Professor of Asian Studies, Political Science, and International Affairs, and Director of the China Policy Program at George Washington University. He'll be speaking Friday at the East-West Center at 5 p.m. on Power Shift or Competitive Coexistence, the U.S.-China Relationship in Southeast Asia.